I wanted to start a little bit left field with an attempt to debunk. As an expert in all things dopamine, what is the number one misconception that you hear day to day or something you see online and go, that is coming up far too often?
Number one, the idea that dopamine is simply associated with pleasure is not correct. It is the final common pathway for all reinforcing and addictive substances and behaviors. But it's also triggered by novelty. It's triggered potentially by aversive or negative stimuli if they're novel in the environment. And it's more, potentially more important for the process of motivation to get the reward rather than the experience of the reward itself.
When thinking of dopamine, I don't know why my mind goes to a genetic lottery in some ways. Is it fair to assume that some people have almost a tragic predisposition to a low baseline of dopamine? Is that accurate?
So there are data showing that that may well be true, and that it may well correlate with the propensity for becoming addicted. That people who are, first of all, let me just say that we come with different vulnerabilities to the problem of addiction. And some of us, indeed, about 10 to 15% of the population, is much more vulnerable to this problem than others. We know this based on family studies. So, for example, if you have a biological parent or grandparent with addiction, you are at increased risk compared to the general population of becoming addicted yourself. It's a complex polygenic phenomenon, so, you know, it's not going to be one gene. It has to do with a combination of, as you suggest, sort of baseline, probably baseline dopamine levels or ability to experience reward. But it's also been linked to things like impulsivity. For example, people who are more impulsive are more likely to become addicted. Impulsivity is defined as not being able to put a pause between the desire or thought to do something and then just doing it, or having less ability to put a pause between those things. It's associated with attention deficit disorder and other frontal lobe dysfunctions, because we think of the prefrontal cortex, which is that gray matter area right behind the forehead, as the part of the brain that's very important to future planning, considering future consequences, delayed gratification. So, and if you think about the brain like a car, the prefrontal cortex is like the brakes of the car, and the reward pathway or lower brain, areas, the limbic brain, is more like the accelerator. So some kind of dysfunction between the brakes and the accelerator in combination is probably what leads to the genetic propensity to become addicted.
You mentioned ADHD. So a low baseline correlates with adults or children that suffer with ADHD?
There's some data showing that if you do functional imaging studies and assess sort of baseline dopamine transmission, there is some variability, and those who have sort of less baseline transmission might be more vulnerable to the development of addiction. That is separate from the data showing that people with attention deficit disorder are more vulnerable to the problem of addiction. All of these are statistical correlations. It's not a one-to-one. If you have ADHD, that doesn't mean you will become addicted. Now, one of the other myths out there, though, is that if you have ADHD and you're treated as a child with stimulant drugs, there was for a while a narrative saying that that protected you from becoming addicted later in life. That is not true. There's a meta-analysis by Humphreys et al. Showing that being treated with stimulants for ADHD as a young person confers no protective element in terms of the increased risk of becoming addicted later in life. And furthermore, if you compare people with ADHD to the general population, those with ADHD are more likely, are at increased risk of becoming addicted in adulthood. And again, it's thought to be some kind of problem in prefrontal cortex, delayed gratification, future planning, So these are separate correlates, sort of baseline dopamine firing, and then just the findings around, the risk of ADHD and addiction.
You hear the term kind of thrown around online, addictive personality. Is that a dated term? And just personally, how do you feel about that term in general? Because I see it a lot online.
Yeah, so I kind of like the term, but it's not one that we use anymore in medicine. We've sort of replaced that term, addictive personality, for just sort of disease risk. We think of addiction as a disease. We base that on family studies and the heritability risk aspect of it, as well as the morphologic and functional brain changes that we see when people have been exposed to drugs for a period of time. There are real brain changes that occur. So therefore, we consider addiction as a disease. Of course, it's not a disease exactly like cancer because it has this behavioral component. And if you never do a drug, you know, you're not going to get the disease. So there's clear differences there. But nonetheless, we think of it as a disease. And then we think about it being a complex biopsychosocial disease, which means that it's a combination, it results from a combination of innate vulnerability, developmental factors, and then exposure in the environment. You can't have addiction without the exposure, but there's a stress vulnerability diathesis, which is to say that some people are going to be much more vulnerable to the problem than others. And the people who are vulnerable are often referred to in lay circles as having, you know, an addictive personality. But again, it's not really a medical term.
One of the most surprising things that I learned in researching for this conversation was when I thought about dopamine baseline and these so-called dopamine spikes, you think you have a spike and then you go back to baseline and then you have another spike and you go to baseline. But I actually heard you talk about after a spike, you dip below baseline. Is that where craving or withdrawal comes from?
Yeah, exactly. And that's really one of the most important messages that I wanted to communicate in my book, Dopamine Nation, was to explain to people the role of homeostasis. And I think of homeostasis as if you imagine there's a balance on a teeter, like a teeter-totter in a kid's playground, and the both sides of that balance represent pleasure and pain. And they're opposite sides of the balance, right? And one of the overriding features governing that balance is it wants to remain level. So you're exactly right. When we experience a pleasure, we get a little release of dopamine in our brain's reward pathway. That balance tips slightly to the side of pleasure. One of the overarching rules governing that balance is that it wants to remain level. It doesn't want to be deviated for very long to the side of pleasure or pain. So the brain will work hard to restore a level balance or homeostasis. And in the case of a sudden spike in dopamine, it will do that by downregulating our own dopamine production and our own dopamine transmission. But importantly, it doesn't just bring the balance level. It actually tips it an equal and opposite amount to the side of pain before restoring a level balance. And this is where, as you describe, it goes below tonic baseline levels of dopamine. We enter a dopamine deficit state. Now, if we wait, and that's, by the way, that's the hangover, the craving, that moment of wanting, you know, one more video game or one more piece of chocolate or, you know, one more alcoholic beverage, whatever it is. If we wait long enough, typically that feeling will pass and homeostasis will be restored. But if we continue to ingest that substance on a regular basis over many days to weeks to months to years, what ends up happening is that we ultimately reset our hedonic set point or our pleasure-pain balance so that it's chronically tilted to the side of pain. It's in this dopamine deficit state. And when we get to that point, that's essentially when we've tipped into the disease of addiction. Because in that state, first of all, our focus is very narrowed on just that one reward, and other things become less interesting and less pleasurable. And now we need to keep using greater quantities and quantities in more potent forms, not to feel good, but just to level the balance, just to restore homeostasis. And importantly, when we're not using our drug of choice, we've now got a balance that's chronically tipped to the side of pain, and we're experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, which is anxiety, irritability, insomnia, depression, and intrusive thoughts of our drug, often called craving.
On that note, and I want to make sure I got this correct, because this was another really interesting moment as I was researching for this conversation. You think, obviously, if someone is in a depressed state or their life circumstances aren't going well, they are at a higher risk for addiction. That seems obvious. But I believe I've heard you speak about someone who is actually at a very high state where everything's going right, where they're living a very exciting life or they're having some great successes in life, might also have a risk for addiction as well. So it's not as simple as life's going bad, you're at risk. For some people, when life's going very, very well, they could also be at risk. Is that accurate for one?
Well, I mean, I think it's accurate in the sense that you know, there are many doorways into substance use and into addictive use. Sometimes people use for pleasure, to have fun, you know, recreationally. Other people use because they're trying to solve a problem. And that problem can take many forms: anxiety, depression, you know, social phobia, boredom. So there are many, many different reasons. Physical pain is another one. But whatever the entryway is into addiction, whether it's to celebrate and have fun, or whether it's to solve a problem, if people discover that it works for either of those purposes, then they're more likely to repeat that experience. And then over time, especially if they progress to regular habitual use, especially daily use, then the brain goes through this process of neuroadaptation where they're then needing more and more to get the same effect. And ultimately where they just change their hedonic set point.
I'm curious about the history of dopamine research. At what point did the scientific community really get a grasp and an understanding for the importance of what dopamine is? Is it relatively recent, or have for the past, you know, 50 years, we had an understanding of how important this molecule is?
So dopamine, the awareness of the molecule dopamine has been around for a long time. We've known that it functioned as a neurotransmitter in animals for a very long time. But it wasn't until the 1950s that it was identified as a neurotransmitter in humans. And since from the 1950s to the present day, there's been an explosion in research on dopamine and its function in animals and in humans, leading to essentially this hypothesis of dopamine as being fundamental for pleasure, motivation, and reward. Interestingly, dopamine has also been identified as fundamental to movement. So, for example, if you think of Parkinson's disease, this is a disease where people become stiff, they have a tremor, they lose the ability to walk and move normally, and it's associated with depletion of dopamine in a part of the brain called the substantia nigra. So it's no coincidence that dopamine is involved both in motivation and in movement. If you look at some of the earliest nematodes, they will release dopamine in response to food in their environment as a way to locomote toward that food. So it makes sense that a molecule that's sort of wired for motivation to get us up off the couch to go get our reward or work for our reward is also connected to movement.
Do you believe that in 2021 today that we've still kind of only scratched the surface on dopamine's role, or do you feel like we have a really firm understanding and that won't change too much in the upcoming decades?
Oh my goodness, no, we're just at the very beginning. You know, the explosion of neuroscience in the last 50 to 100 years is so new, and there's been so much incredible work, but I still just think we're, you know, it's at the very beginnings. And even my book, where I talk about this pleasure-pain balance and the role of dopamine, I suspect in, you know, 50 years or even less, it's going to be outdated. There will be new findings that show a more nuanced role.
In this podcast, we've had a lot of conversations about social media. We have a lot of young listeners, and that is a pretty serious topic. There isn't very much middle ground. There are a lot of people that are digital minimalists that don't use social media, and there are some people that believe that it is not as big of an issue, that it's maybe been made out to be. What are your thoughts on social media as we have a conversation with dopamine and addiction? Can it be just as addictive as a traditional substance we think of?
So my general sense in life is that the truth usually lies somewhere in between. So I always like to acknowledge, you know, the benefits and the wonder really of the technology and what social media has afforded us. And the ways in which it's enabled really meaningful human connections all around the globe. Having said that, it is inherently reinforcing and has been engineered to be a drug. The people who have made social media have, you know, studied, and they're smart people, exactly how to craft it to keep us clicking and swiping. They do that in a number of different ways, you know, which I'm sure you're familiar with and your audience is familiar with, but I can go through if you'd like. But the bottom line is that it is potentially an addictive drug, especially for a subset of vulnerable individuals. And this is where I think it's important to introduce the concept of drug of choice. So what that means is that we're not all wired exactly the same. Our basic pleasure-pain balance is the same. You know, our basic sort of wiring is homologous or similar across humans, but there's also an enormous amount of inter-individual variability. And so what that means is that what tips your pleasure-pain balance to the side of pleasure might not tip my pleasure-pain balance to the side of pleasure, right? And so social media for the vast majority of people is going to be something that they can use in moderation. When it starts to get a little out of control, they can course correct. But for individuals for whom it happens to be their drug of choice, it will potentially be extremely difficult for them to manage their consumption once they get going. And so I think that that's really the message, that it's not, you know, let's throw the baby out with the bathwater, or that everybody uses social media is going to get addicted to social media, but just acknowledging that there is a subset of people for whom it will be their drug of choice. Once they get on it, it will be so highly reinforcing for them that they will get into this vortex of compulsive overconsumption. It does release dopamine in the reward pathway because we are wired to connect with other humans. And we do release dopamine when people like us, validate us, have the same emotion that we're having at the same time. And if we continue to pulse our reward pathway with that particular drug, inevitably we're going to downregulate our own endogenous dopamine production and end up in this dopamine deficit state, which then drives repeated reuse, even when it's not fun anymore. And I think that's really, you know, sort of the final common pathway of many different addiction cycles, is that we get to a place where it's not working and it's not fun, and yet we can't stop.
In terms of finding that drug of choice, the strange part about, I guess, social media is the age you're introduced to it versus other potential drugs of choice. So at what point does, maybe in regards to social media, but how important is it that at what age you're introduced to that quote-unquote drug of choice? Because there are probably a lot of, you know, 10, 11, 12-year-olds that are introduced to social media in comparison to maybe high school or college for other drugs. So does age come into play in terms of finding that drug of choice?
I mean, we think that it does. So for traditional drugs, the earlier that you start using a drug, you know, the more likely you are to get addicted to that drug. We also know that adolescence is a very crucial time in brain development. There's a process called pruning that happens, where in adolescence, the beginning of adolescence, we have a ton of neurons, but we're only selectively using some of those neurons. So the ones that we're not using, our brain actually cuts away and prunes back on, like pruning a tree or a bush, so that by the time we get to about age 25, we're just left with those neurons that we use repeatedly, and then those neurons are myelinated. So a fatty sheath is put on them to make them more efficient. So what that means is that the coping strategies for life that we develop in those first two decades are really critical, because they will determine, you know, how our brains are wired for adulthood. And if we develop maladaptive or unhealthy coping strategies in that crucial period, it's going to be that much harder to change the wiring later on. Not impossible, because neurogenesis or the creation of new neurons continues throughout life, but harder.
In terms of different types of addictions, we've talked about traditional substances and social media as obvious ones. I wanted to talk about what would be seemingly positive addictions. I have a lot of young listeners that might be work addicted, or they're in university and they spend a great deal of time career focused. Do you have the conversation of the seemingly positive addictions, and can you be addicted to work or school, things that are, I guess, applauded?
So when I use the word addiction, inherent in that term is psychopathology or maladaptive coping. If a person has like a positive passion or, you know, healthy obsession or something like that, I probably would use different terminology. Is it possible to get addicted to things like work and exercise? It absolutely is, although it tends to be harder because those are endeavors that require effortful engagement over longer periods of time with delayed rewards. So they're less susceptible to the problem of tolerance and dependence and withdrawal, although those phenomena still can happen, which is different from an intoxicant, right? Where we take it and we immediately feel its effects. And then it's followed by this dopamine deficit plummet below baseline levels. But certainly people can develop a compulsive orientation to things like work. And the intervention is essentially the same. Again, a period of abstinence followed by, you know, contemplation and then deciding if and how people want to return to using that drug or behavior.
On that note, I hear a lot about, and I've read a lot of articles about the idea of a dopamine detox or a quote-unquote dopamine reset. So I wanted to ask you if that is something that is realistic and if it's something that you recommend, the idea of 30 days off social media, 30 days without a substance, etc. Is there a reality to a dopamine detox or reset?
Yeah, so I mean, this is essentially what my book Dopamine Nation is about. It's not just about the problem of dopamine overload, but also what to do about it. And the whole latter two-thirds of the book start with talking about a dopamine fast as the first intervention. And that is taking a break, ideally 30 days, but it can be less, from our drug of choice, whatever that is, whether it's, you know, Instagram or TikTok or cannabis or chocolate cake, whatever it is. And the reason behind that is because we need to stop bombarding our dopamine reward pathway, you know, in order to restore a level balance or homeostasis, in order to get our own systems to start to make our own dopamine again and upregulate dopamine. So that's really the primary reason for that dopamine fast. But the secondary reason is that when we're, you know, in our addiction, it's very hard to see true cause and effect, and we often can't appreciate the adverse impact of our use on our lives and on the people around us when we're in it. So taking a break allows us to kind of get that perspective and look back and see the true impact on our lives. Oftentimes patients, after a 30-day dopamine fast, will come in and say, I can't believe that I did X, Y, or Z when I was using that drug. I can't believe I was so invested in it. I look back now, they'll say, for example, and I don't even recognize myself. So I think that those are, you know, what really convinced me, as well as, you know, the dopamine fast that I've taken in my own life for my own compulsive overconsumption problems, allowing me to really see, you know, to know. Sometimes that dopamine fast is the way you find out if you were addicted in the first place. Like, maybe you can't even stop for 30 days, right? That's important information. Maybe it was a lot harder than you thought it was going to be. Maybe there were a lot more physical signs of withdrawal than you were expecting. For example, my patient who quit cannabis and was violently vomiting in the first 2 weeks, that was the first time that she really realized how addicted she had become to cannabis. So that really is the first step. And then the rest of the book talks about sort of what to do after the dopamine fast. A lot of times if you read about dopamine fasting, it never says what to do afterwards. Whereas my book really details, okay, well, after that dopamine fast, talk about what was good about it, talk about what was bad about it, decide whether you want to continue to abstain for another month or whether you want to go back to using. And if you want to go back to using, you know, how do you want to use differently? And then engaging with self-finding strategies to try to moderate consumption.
We're going to link the book in our description to go deeper in this topic. But if there's somebody who is listening to this and says, I'm going to take the leap, I'm going to spend 30 days off of blank, 30 days without blank, what can they realistically expect? And is there a few go-to things to make those 30 days more bearable and more manageable? Because they sound like a real challenge.
Yeah, can be a real challenge. First of all, I would say a couple caveats. Like if you've tried repeatedly to stop before and weren't able to, you probably need a higher level of care. Maybe you need to go see an addiction medicine specialist. Maybe you need to go to a rehab. Also, if you're somebody who's really physically dependent on alcohol or benzos like Xanax or opioids, again, I would recommend you see a medical doctor and not try to do a dopamine fast on your own, because the withdrawal from those substances can be life-threatening. So this is, broadly speaking, you know, something that is for people who are more mildly addicted. For those who aren't more severely addicted, I strongly urge those folks to go and see a professional about it. But on the mild addiction spectrum, you know, what people can do is, first of all, they can plan a quit date. So it's sort of on their calendar. It's often good to tell other people so that you're accountable not just to yourself, but also to others. If you can do the dopamine fast together with other people, that often helps because you're not alone. And then especially if you're meeting with that other person, you know, as a way of supporting you in that endeavor. There are also lots of resources online and in person, like 12-Step Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, or lots of sort of sober curious, sober full, sober life online groups that can help people get support in that way. The other really important thing is to recognize that you will feel worse before you feel better, but that's not the you that you'll have to live with without your substance. That is withdrawal. Again, the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, depression, and craving. But people can also have physical withdrawal depending on the drug, restlessness, muscle jerks, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, all kinds of different things. But it's all time limited. So if you can just get through about the first 2 weeks, usually by week 3 and 4, people start feeling much better. They're less anxious, they're less depressed, they're craving less. It's easier to go through their day without thinking about using. The other things I recommend, just sort of tricks I've learned over the years, is radical truth telling. So in that period, I usually prescribe no lying about anything, because once we're lying about even little things, we're more likely to lie about our drug and addictive substance or behavior use. And then exercise or other forms of leaning on the pain side of the balance can really be helpful. Because if you think about it, this pleasure-pain balance, once you take the drug off of the pleasure side, you've already got these, what I call these neuroadaptation gremlins on the pain side. They're going to tip you down into that dopamine deficit state. But believe it or not, if you actually press on the pain side, you're going to get those gremlins to hop on the pleasure side and bring you back to homeostasis faster. And there are lots of studies showing that exercise mitigates the symptoms of withdrawal, helps to prevent relapse, and actually helps to prevent the development of addiction in the first place.